Hello, and welcome back to A Soldier, A Sailor, and A Scientist. This week, Peter Roberts and I talk to Stephen Mears about artificial intelligence. He starts by telling us how he ended up working at DSTL. Enjoy.
So that's a kind of a funny story, actually. So I was doing a PhD down at Southampton University, and one day I found a copy of The New Scientist that had been left around in the common room at the university. And on the back page, there was this advert for a job doing sonar analysis at DSTL. I thought, God, that looks amazing. I'm going to chuck my name in for that. Went to all the interview, kind of first day in the office, really excited. Walked into this like super secret, secure office and found one of my PhD supervisors sat in there. And it turned out the whole time I've been doing my PhD, I could never find him on a Friday. And the reason was he was up at DSTL and taking some of like the exciting research that he was doing and applying it to real data sets. And I said to him, you didn't leave a copy of The New Scientist hanging around in the common room, did you?
Just like, in case.
Might have done. Yeah. So anyway, so yeah, that's kind of where my career started, was looking at sonar off submarines. And over the years, kind of data, and whether that's data from submarines, data from satellites, data from all kinds of sensors in the battlefield, that's kind of been the sort of the golden thread in my career that's led me now to work on AI.
But it's something that's evolved massively, right? I mean, you know, data sets, for example, people now talk about clean and dirty data sets. They talk about the number of data sets they can take in. It feels almost like a natural evolution, isn't it? It's sort of moving from data science into AI, or is there a magic leap?
Absolutely not. So I would say 80% of every AI project I've worked on has been about the data. Really digging into your data, telling you, is really important. People get really excited about AI, and it is. It's a really exciting area. I love the job I do, but really AI is like the icing on top of the cake. The cake is made out of data.
And that's really difficult, isn't it? But I mean, I just remember, you know, from a naval career where we should have had loads of databases to populate, you know, that would make systems work better. But we're not really very good at populating databases. But they are, as you say, absolutely crucial, aren't they? But when you move on, this sort of move from databases has then sort of gone through AI, and we'll come to what we mean by AI maybe in a minute. But it sort of went through ML first, this machine learning thing first, didn't it? Does that have the same relationship with, is that just, again, different icing on the top?
So I think this is one of the challenges around AI, is it means different things to different people. I actually think it's really simple in that, for me, AI is about the ability of a system to learn to complete a task. And if it doesn't learn, it's not intelligent. So often people kind of mix up all sorts of different things and say, oh, that's AI. Sometimes it might just be like a really simple kind of rules-based automated kind of thing, like a robot in a factory that's making cars or something. For me, that's not intelligent. That's just an automated system. For me, the key thing that we're trying to build into our systems is the ability to learn. So machine learning is a really strong example of artificial intelligence. That's when most people say AI, I think they actually mean machine learning. And that's where we've just seen such incredible progress over the last 10 or 15 years. You know, you've probably seen it as much as I, but image classifiers that can be better than the human eye at spotting things, all kinds of games that people thought would never be won by a computer have now been routinely beaten. So it's just such an exciting area. But I think it is one where there's an awful lot of excitement and a lot of misunderstandings about what it is and what it isn't.
It is, because there's an amazing definition around AI, isn't it? That, you know, some people say it has to be sentient. Yeah, and at that point you start thinking, oh my God, what is being developed here? This is quite crazy. I mean, and therefore, you know, when you speak to like Nina Collins in America, you know, professor of AI at the Naval War College, you know, and she will talk about, you know, this idea that we are decades away from that sentient moment. But we're not decades away from AI, depending on how you define it, right?
AI is like here today. We are all interacting with it, you know, dozens and dozens of times a day. For me, you know, when I get up in the morning, I'm checking my newsfeed on my phone. There's AI all over that. There's AI in terms of how I interact with all kinds of different systems. So for me, yeah, artificial general intelligence is really exciting. And when that kind of moment happens where we do get some kind of sentient machine, that is going to be a genuine, like, existential moment for humanity. But what I don't want it to do is to distract us from all of the really important applications of AI that we're having to deal with here today. And for me, particularly in the military domain, there are just so many really impactful areas where we can apply current day AI techniques in a way that would really help warfighters.
So we'll get this straight, that we're not going to see, you know, the singularity. This is not what we're working on, right? It's grey goo, is the world being reduced to, you know, a sort of a matrix type thing. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about something that has that we have around us every day, and we're talking about militarizing those applications to produce better, stronger signatures.
So when I talk about AI, I try and categorize it into three buckets. The first bucket I use is what's called narrow AI. And almost all of the different applications of AI you will see in use today are what's called narrow AI. And that doesn't mean they're not incredibly powerful, but what it does mean is that they're very highly specialized one-trick ponies that can be fantastic at the task that they're trained to do, but they can't generalize. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got this kind of artificial general intelligence, which people typically define as being an algorithm that can do anything that a human can, any intellectual task that a human can, and that's that kind of moment of sentience that you're talking about. And as I said, that's really important. We need to keep a really close eye on it because, you know, if we get that wrong, if we can't control that system, we've got a huge, huge existential problem on our hands. But for me, the interesting bit is in the middle. I call that broad AI. So it's not general intelligence that can do anything that a human can, but it's not a one-trick pony either. And we're beginning to see some examples of algorithms that are coming out of the universities, out of some of the industry research labs now, and here at DSTL as well, that I would call broad AI, which are AI that can begin to generalize, can begin to sort of take what it's learned in one area and apply it to another area, that begin to have some sort of common sense. And we're a long way off from that, and that will be a massive, massive leap when we get there. But for me, I'm much more excited about broad AI than I am about artificial general intelligence, because that is a long way away, as you say.
So in that, I'll just try to picture it in my mind just to get it clear. So broad AI, it's not like a turbocharger, right, which you can stick in any car, because it's got to learn something, right? That's the important. So it's got to learn something. So is it like a new engine management chip that you could throw in any car that would improve its performance or whatever, and actually you could take from a car and put into something else? Is that what we're talking about?
So I would say we're still figuring it out.
Yeah.
It's still research. But if you think about how a baby learns, so children are incredible learners. If you've got young kids, you will have seen, I don't know, they might learn that if they push a toy off their high chair, it makes a funny clattering noise, and, you know, maybe they learn quite quickly that it breaks and to stop doing that. They will learn that off, you know, maybe five or six times, and then they know, and then they can apply that. If we had to try and teach a machine using narrow AI techniques to do that, we'd need to give it thousands and thousands of examples. So I guess another example might be like a cat. You know, any baby can learn to identify a cat really quickly, and then you show them a grey cat rather than a black cat, they still know it's a cat. If we have to train an AI to do that, it's actually really hard. If you think about how many different rules you might come up with for what makes a cat, it's got pointy ears, it's got whiskers, it's got a furry tail, there will always be some kind of variation you've not thought of. So for me, what I think broad AI is about is trying to teach machines to learn a little bit more like humans do.
Trying to teach them heuristics, essentially.
Yeah.
A generalization that you can take.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So there's an amazing book called Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow by Danny Kahneman, who was, I think it was a Nobel Prize winning kind of scientist. And he talked about in all of our brains, we have what he called System 1 and what he called System 2. And basically, we're really lazy. And system one is like those heuristics that you mentioned, our like real like snap judgments where we will see something and we will instantly, we don't have to think about it, we just know it. Where system two is when we've really got to think, and that's hard work. And so our brains like to be in system one. So, you know, I guess where you might get to with all of this is that AI can do some more of that kind of system two thinking, the really kind of hard cognitive stuff, putting what it's learned into context. So, yeah, as I said, AI is a really important field, but we're still learning an awful lot. There's an awful lot of research to do, but there's also an awful lot of really mature technology that we can just apply to defences problems. And so in DSTL, we're in that really exciting space of trying to take the technology that's been proven to work in other areas and really think, how could that help the warfighter? How could that help save lives? How could that give more operational advantage to the UK? And I find that really exciting.
So, and it's interesting because I guess for the last 5 years, right, every senior officer sprinkles AI into every speech that they've talked about and saying, you know, this is the pixie dust that's going to solve all our problems for the future. So what's DSTL? What are you working on in AI terms? You know, give us a feel for what that's like for you.
So I think AI is one of the most ubiquitous technologies anywhere in defence. It's not an end in itself, but it is a technology that can really transform lots and lots of different parts of defence. So within DSTL, we've got scientists and engineers that are conducting all kinds of different research activities, from looking at AI for command and control applications and how we might be able to increase the operational tempo in a military headquarters by injecting, you know, AI into small amounts of what headquarters does. We're not talking about replacing humans. We're talking about augmenting some of the kind of manual repetitive tasks that a lot of humans undertake.
Is that the sort of thing that, so narrow AI would probably be very useful for?
Yeah.
I think like Google Maps, you know, that gave me three different ways I could come here, and I made a decision from the airport to here based on, you know, my assessment of the freeways and gate, but it would have taken me ages to get the map out and do all that sort of
stuff. So another example is natural language processing. So how you deal with large amounts of text, you know, trying to quickly assimilate, you know, a really long document, or even worse, you know, a pile of really long documents. How could we use AI to help the human commander more quickly kind of understand what's going on around them? How can we help them spend more of their time doing the thing that they're really good at, which is understanding the operational context, analysing different courses of action, thinking through the operational risks, and how can we use the machines to take away some of the like really sort of dull discovery work that can help them? So, yeah, command and control we think is a really exciting area. I mean, just the same, actually, in the whole kind of intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance, the kind of the ISR space, logistics, cyber, countering fake news. That's a really, really interesting one. So it is one of those technologies that is absolutely everywhere in terms of the research that DSTL is doing. So I'll give you a few specific projects if you're interested in. So team that DSTL runs is up at the Centre for Intelligence Innovation, RAF Witten, and that's where, you know, there's a lot of military analysts that are analysing all kinds of intelligence feeds from around the world. They've been incredibly busy with Ukraine recently, and in particular, they get an awful lot of satellite imagery that comes into Witten, far more than they've got enough imagery analysts to train to look at. So the DSTL team up at RAF Witten have developed a system called Spotter. Spotter uses a narrow AI technique called convolutional neural networks to analyse satellite imagery and to extract objects from that imagery so that the analysts can quickly get to the imagery that they need to look at. So if we can triage all of the satellite imagery that's coming into RAF Witten and prioritise them and say these are the ones that need a human analyst to go away and look at. That's the problem that Spotter's trying to solve.
Is that a bit similar to, I mean, there's, Ukraine has just seen open source intelligence, you know, on a massive scale, in particular in identifying, you know, fighting vehicles, movements, you know, large movements of troops, convoys, ammunition dumps, you know, and actually it's open source that feels like it's being, is that similar to that? And is there then a difference in what the guys at Witten are doing and what's been done, you know, in actually quite a small number of open source intelligence companies or places?
So we think the kind of traditional paradigm of intelligence analysis is flipping on its head. For years, it's been, you know, a large number of classified sources of information that have been accessorized by some open sources. And as you rightly say, I think that paradigm has been flipped. So, you know, using all of the different open source tools that are available to us, but then using our kind of incredibly capable kind of classified sources to corroborate, to get independent verification of what we're seeing in the open source community. And again, you know, AI and, you know, the data science and the data engineering that sits underneath that is absolutely critical. If you're going to exploit that sort of fire hose of open source intelligence, you're going to need some kind of AI or data science solution to do it.
You said you were going to give us two advantages. So that was one,
yeah,
at Witten.
So let me give you another one. So in November last year, DSTL had a critical role in delivering the contested urban environment experiment in Portsmouth. This was a really large experiment with lots of nations all coming to the UK to explore how we could improve urban operations, and particularly, again, the ISR enterprise. So at the Q experiment, Contested Urban Environment, Q, we demonstrated a system called Sapient. Sapient is an AI-enabled intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance architecture. It allows us to bolt together lots of different AI-enabled sensors, and then fuse all of those different sensors into like an autonomous sensor network, and then again using AI choose what to expose to a human operator. So I want you to put yourself in the shoes of a security guard that's been sat in a hot, dusty, smelly porter cabin somewhere with a bank of CCTV monitors in front of them, maybe 20 or 30 CCTV monitors. How well do you think you would do in an 8-hour shift trying to find the 30 seconds of really important information in that information? If you're anything like me, you'd be awful at it. So that's the kind of the problem that Sapient's trying to solve. So at Q, we used AI in the Sapient architecture so that different sensors, whether it was an electro-optic like a camera or a thermal imager or an overhead UAV, or even like electromagnetic sensing what's happening in the EM spectrum. We were using AI to fuse all of that information together and then provide like an integrated local operating picture, was what we called it, to the human commander to say, this is a bit unusual, you might want to have a closer look at that. So it's a way, again, of helping, using AI to help the human do better at their role, enabling that human outcome to be better than it might be otherwise.
I mean, that strikes me as a pattern of life study that a soldier would do from a Sanger or from a sentry position.
Yeah,
so that,
yeah.
Okay. Delete your porter cabin and all the screens. We'd have hundreds of bases over the conflicts we've been through. A soldier stands on a sentry position and looks out for people, but he also looks out, or she looks out for the pattern of life in front of them. Particularly in a counterinsurgency campaign, like, because you want to understand, is this normal and this sentient?
Sapient.
Sorry,
that's right.
Sapient.
Can
do that for you, or can give you a bit of assurance on top of that.
And what I love about Sapient so much is what's called an open architecture. That sounds really boring, but it's actually really important. And why it's so important is that it defines all of the standards, all of the interfaces that allow us to plug together lots of different industry providers' solutions. So, you know, we could have a really world-leading sensor from, you know, say, Kinetic or a company like that, and then we could make sure it can talk to another world-leading sensor from, Northrop Grumman or Lockheed Martin and things. And for me, that's where it gets so powerful. You're not just using AI in one little narrow sort of application on one little sensor. Using AI to make all of these things talk together, and that I think is where we get some massive competitive advantage for our people, because it can help us get after things like pattern of life. It can help us take the absolute best technology from whichever company it comes from and make it all work together. That's really hard, but what an important problem.
But there's also something else on this, isn't there, that I'm guessing, knowing DSTL for years, that you'll also be looking at, which is lots of these techniques, processes that AI uses could be potentially dangerous. They could run in the way of the way that we want wars to be fought in the future, right? They run against our morals and our ethics and all this stuff. So I'm imagining that part of DSTL has this program that says, you know, we're going to be governed by these following standards, right? These ethics. And that works alongside. So what I've seen a lot in academia is that the intellectual discussion about how you're going to use AI systems is some way behind the technology, and it lags. So you've got these great leaps in AI and who can read data and, you know, what the database could be used for, or just databases being released, without that argument of should it be released, should it not be released, how is it going to be used. Now, I'm guessing here that there is a sort of, I don't know, it's part of your role looking at the compliance to a bunch of, you know, codes, morals, ethics, behaviours that we see, this is how we want AI to develop, right?
So I think this is absolutely critically important. If you say the word AI to, you know, the average person on the street, they start worrying about their job. If you say AI in defence, they start worrying about the Terminator and killer robots. And for me, understanding how we can responsibly and ethically harness AI for the warfighter in a way that makes the world a better place and a safer place really is like a critical challenge for our generation. So I feel really motivated as a scientist working at DSTL to try and make sure that we are making good choices about how we apply AI to what we do. So we think really hard about, you know, the misuse, what some of the downsides might be. You might have seen that in June, the MOD published a document called Ambitious, Safe and Responsible, which described the five ethical principles that MOD...
Well, I didn't read it, mate, so you're going to have to run me through. Well, can you remember the five?
Oh, you're going to put me on the spot now. But it's all about making sure that we don't build AI systems that are biased, making sure that we reduce the overall level of harm and use AI as a force for good. It's making sure that AI systems can still be accountable. A human commander still ultimately has to be accountable for the military that they are applying. There's a big focus on trustworthiness, so making sure that AI systems can be trusted by the commander, but also trusted by the public that ultimately we all serve. So those ethical principles really run through all of our work here at DSTL. What we are increasingly doing is all of the scientists here are working in multidisciplinary teams. So I've got teams of software developers, I've got teams of machine learning engineers and data scientists. But then what we're doing is budding them up with like AI ethicists who can be working with them right from the outset, not like coming in as a sticking plaster at the end, but really like working with them in partnership. We also work with like user experience designers and human factors experts to make sure that we can really put the human at the centre of all the systems we build. We also work really closely with the military domain experts. They're really, really important because they help the scientists and engineers understand how this can help. So, yeah, in answer to your question, ethics and responsible AI, it's absolutely the heart of our approach. And then we're trying to use this kind of multidisciplinary way of working to really make sure that we design systems that work and that really make the world a better place.
It's interesting at the start of that you talked about bias, though, because you know, having read a bit about AI, that there is a increasing worry from some academic circles that, you know, bias in AI, even from writing, you know, the database that you collect at the start, will give you a different answer. So if you go back to cats, mm-hmm. you know, if it was just about, you know, whiskers and nose and ears, then, you know, 50% of what you get would be dogs. And if you put that into a C2 system or an ISR system, you could come up with the wrong answer. So what are the big risks in AI? If we're really thinking about bias and our level of trust and accountability, what are the real risks that we're left with AI that keep you up at night?
Yeah, so I think bias is a real challenge, and it's almost inescapable in that no matter how hard we try, bias is always baked into our data sets. And if the way the machines learn is through some kind of data, which is inevitable, you know, it's almost impossible to completely remove that bias from the system. But the thing that gives me hope is that we shouldn't be holding our AI systems to an unachievable standard. We are all biased. Every human has his or her own biases, and that, you know, that's dependent on, you know, how we've grown up, what experiences we've had in our lives.
Well, I think it goes back to what we talked about earlier. You're trying to teach common sense, and that is part of what bias does, isn't it?
Yeah,
the
yeah.
heuristics we talked about yeah. allows the human to quickly identify a cat because yeah. their biases teach it quickly. That's probably a cat. It meows. It's got four legs, a tail, yeah. pointy ears.
Yeah.
But actually, it might not be. It might be something slightly different.
Yeah.
But there's a real tension there, then, isn't there?
Yeah.
What
I think helps, though, is that I can measure the bias in an AI system. If you had to put a percentage on me of how biased I am, a different thing. How on earth would you do that? I can actually write down a percentage of how biased a machine learning system is. So a very well-known and really unfortunate example is the fact that facial recognition doesn't work as well on people of different ethnic origins, because a lot of the faces in the training set have been white faces. You know, that is an unacceptable outcome. But the good thing is I can sit down and I can work out repeatedly how many times the AI system gets it wrong. If I can measure it, I can fix it. So for me, when people talk about bias in AI systems, it's a really important problem. But I worry that people sometimes attach a sort of an unattainable gold standard of this AI system can have no bias in it whatsoever, but not recognizing that actually we're biased as humans, and if we can make AI systems that are less biased than humans, that at least is a net positive. For me, a lot of my time is spent trying to kind of manage the hype, if you see what I mean. So the analogy that I like to draw is relating to kind of autonomous cars, and how actually I think what we're going to see is the gradual introduction of more and more AI, more and more autonomy into the still human-led process of driving a car. You know, it might be helping you stay within your lane. It might be pre-priming your brakes, or even automatically activating your brakes if you're about to get into a crash. And I think what we're going to see in the automotive sector is the gradual kind of introduction of more and more AI and autonomy into the car driving process. And it might be in, you know, I don't know how many years, but at some point, you know, we'll go to fully self-driving cars. But I think actually it's happening a lot slower than people expected because of those trust issues and some of the fatalities we see. I think we're going to see exactly the same thing in the military domain. And a bit like we were talking about in a military headquarters, how can we begin to just improve the quality of life for officers in a military headquarters, initially in some fairly small focus tasks, and then incrementally getting more and more AI into the system till, you know, maybe in 10 or 15 years, some of those things you mentioned might be possible. But what I don't want to do is to overinflate expectations, get people thinking that AI is some kind of silver bullet or kind of magic that can solve all of their problems. It's a really powerful technology, but we need to take baby steps to get to the big changes.
It's at the start of a military career, right? It took a long time for the military to trust me to do anything. So I imagine
still don't, generally.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. And I think about this a bit like, you know, how we've introduced flight into military operations, how we've introduced precision-guided weapons, how we've introduced kind of the manoeuvrist-type approach. It will take time to figure out how we can really incorporate AI into our ways of working and our kind of military tradecraft. It's not going to be something that's going to happen, you know, overnight in a year or two. We can definitely get some quick wins, but this is a marathon, not a sprint. This is something that is incredibly profound in terms of its potential impact on the military domain, and we need to be in this for the long haul. And it's so, I mean, I feel so admiring of all of the experimentation and all of the user-led stuff. There are people all over the MOD who are just rolling their sleeves up and seeing what they can do in this space. And it's that kind of spirit of kind of experimentation and trying and learning and failing and things that's going to get us the outcomes that we want. And then you may have also seen that what we're now doing as part of the Defence AI strategy is establishing a Defence AI Centre. And that's really trying to support all of those different local innovators around defence and make it easier for them to make changes in their area.
But that's the essential bit, right? Because you're talking about, you know, already we have all these sort of AI ML systems that are already using maybe the same databases in a lot of circumstances. They're all putting it together, maybe coming out with different answers. Everyone is developing these, sometimes in stovepipes. Someone's got to be able to draw them together so they can exchange, so they can be used to validate and verify, so they can share knowledge and understanding. I mean, that's got to be the keystone, right?
And that is exactly what the Defence AI Centre, or the DAIC, as we call it, has been created to do. So the DAIC is a partnership between UK Strategic Command, Defence Equipment and Support, DSTL, and then working with all the different frontline commands and top-level budgets across defence. And exactly what you just said is what the DAIC is trying to do. It's not about trying to do all of defence's AI work in one place or one building. It's about trying to build a community across defence. It's about trying to share best practice between different areas. It's about trying to come up with common solutions that everybody's banging their head against and figure out how we can solve it once for everybody. And I think perhaps most importantly, it's about being the kind of the visionary champion for AI within defence, really helping defence understand what AI could do for it. So as well as my work here at DSTL, I'm leading DSTL's contribution into the DAIC. And so it's a really exciting time to be working in AI in defence.
It gets back to that just that talk about the central pillar for putting all this together. But it gets back to one of your points about trustworthiness. Because, you know, if you've developed a system with AI, right, that looks at databases, you know, you understand, you'll trust it, right? Same way Fusty would trust, you know, some of his section, a platoon, a company, you know, you would trust those people. You know which are the good, which are the bad, you wish to take with a pinch of salt. I would trust, you know, different missile systems or radars or sailors. You know, we have a different relationship with trust. But then to suddenly give Frosty a completely new AI system going, this is going to give you, you know, your answers to your ISR. There's got to be a point in there that trust becomes a really big part that we've got to overcome, rather than just, you know, I see a raw radar return, that's where it is. You get to different.
I couldn't agree more. And for me, it's about this kind of incremental process that I was describing earlier. So, for example, we do an awful lot of experimentation work in DSTL and working with our other partners in frontline commands. And to make that work, we need to use what's called agile techniques. You might have heard of DevOps or DevSecOps. The new sort of buzzword is MLOps, machine learning operations. But for me, what's so important about that is you need to get the people developing the systems, the scientists and the engineers that can build these systems, you need to get them alongside people like Frosty and kind of really understanding what are the problems that you're encountering? What are the things that would make you trust this system? What are the things that would be a problem for you? How can we make this work for you? How can we do that kind of support? And that MLOps approach is become the kind of the industry norm in the civil sector. It's how banks, it's how insurance companies, you know, that's how everybody delivers AI into operational use. And so what we're trying to do with the Defence AI Centre is take some of that industry best practice and get it working for us within defence. So, you know, I know, you know, warfighters are, you know, they've got a huge task on their hands, but if there are, you know, a little bit of time that they can spare to work with the scientists and engineers to help us understand how the systems that we're building can be made to work for them, where we can get our hands on real data, that is like gold dust. Those are the things that are going to help us build those trustworthy systems. And what we're really trying to do is harness the best and the brightest minds that we can get anywhere in the UK and get them working on our problems. So in DSTL, we're working with some really like world-leading AI industry companies. We've got links that we got to some of the best universities in the world. We want to get all of that brain power solving your problems. So that, I think, that kind of agile approach, working really closely between the scientists and the end users, that is the way that we'll get to that kind of trustworthy state that you mentioned.
Interesting that you focused there on the UK. And you know, when you look at the UK's budget, government spending on AI, it's pretty big, right? But it's tiny compared to the US and even India. Israel has been working with ML systems for the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, for a long time, right? Operationalizing it, very, very, you know, frontline focused, maybe even without some of the more without some of the ethical and moral restrictions that you might be, you know, that we might have to work with here, right? And that's fine. So how much of this stuff do you do that is just UK, and how much is done in cooperation with others? How are you able to pull in like the big lessons from India or Thailand or Australia or wherever? Is there a sort of Five Eyes NATO working groups that you relate this to, or is it all very stovepipe? Because this stuff really is just, it's still behind the curtain, right, in many circumstances.
So adopting AI is absolutely a team sport. And if we think that we've got all the answers here in MOD or DSTL, we're kidding ourselves. And I spend a huge amount of my time building relationships, doing technical exchanges with other companies, with international partners. So we obviously do a huge amount of work with the US, and we have joint teams that are developing solutions. Also with the AUKUS, the trilateral MOU that's been established recently, there is an AI working group under that initiative. We have a Five Eyes experimentation thing, so that contested urban environment experiment I told you about, that was a big Five Eyes experiment. I think we had over 30 or 40 systems that came from all of the different international partners. And then finally, we're, I think, trying to expand our approach out to some of the international partners that maybe we don't traditionally work with quite so much, kind of beyond the kind of the NATO nations. So for example, I'm part of something called the AI Partnership for Defence, which is a 16 nation initiative that involves the likes of Singapore, Japan, South Korea, Israel, a part of that actually, as well as some of the more traditional kind of NATO partners that you would expect to see. So it is massively a team sport. The other thing I just quickly want to say on that is that we are so pleased with how engaged some of the big technology companies are being with defence. They want to use the benefit of all of their experience to help us get the right outcomes for AI within defence. So as well as all the normal kind of defence primes that we're working with, we're also talking to the big tech companies and trying to draw upon their huge resources to help us get after this problem for the warfighters.
Yeah, I got two final questions for you, Steve. One is what keeps you up at night? You know, in AI, with DSTR, what keeps you up at night and you sit there going, I mean, is it the commute to work? Is it budget? Is it how far you're allowed to run? You know, your lunchtime. What is it that keeps you up at night? What worries you most about this?
There's maybe a couple of different answers to that question. So the first answer is maybe that kind of big generational challenge. I could imagine some futures where AI is a wonderful force for good that really reduces the overall level of harm in warfare, that saves lives, that helps our commanders make better, quicker decisions, that makes the business of war fighting, less bad for the world. But I could also imagine some horrendous scenarios, particularly, for example, like information warfare and like misinformation flying around. So for me, I feel really responsible as a scientist and engineer trying to make sure that we take the right steps that get us towards that kind of outcome. What we could see is a kind of a race to the bottom where countries kind of, you know, sort of taking more and more steps that really push us down a path. So I worry about that. That feels to me like a really big challenge. The second thing I worry about is what we call the AI paradox. So it's quite easy to do, it's not easy, but it's easier to do an experiment in a lab and show, doesn't this AI system look great? But then there's a big difference between that fantastic experiment in a lab and rolling out an operational capability to tens of thousands of military users. So how can we get more AI into the hands of warfighters in a way that they can trust it and rely on it? So that's the second thing I worry about. And then the third thing and the final thing is about the best and the brightest brains. AI is one of the most sought-after skills anywhere in the world at the moment. We need to make sure that we can attract the best and the brightest people to come and work on some of these really important problems. If we're going to solve some of these things, we need the smartest, the most committed, the most dedicated people who can come and work with us. So for me, making sure that we've got access to the best talent that we can, and DSTL's got a fantastic role, and we're working really hard to bring all those bright minds together, but the more bright minds we can get solving our problems to give operational advantage to end users, the better. So, yeah, those are.
And I guess that links in perfectly to my final question to you, which is, listen, you know a lot about AI. You're in an industry, an area of industry that is seriously in demand globally. You could walk out of here into, something with rock star wages, which is not something that government pays civil servants. And that's the fact of life, right? Industry would desperately love to get their hands on you and pay you well, and you take your family on, weekend breaks to the Seychelles or wherever it would be. I mean, you would have like a really good life. What keeps you at DSTL? What keeps you working for the government? What is that thing that says, yeah, I'm staying here. I'm sorry, darling. We're going on a leaky tenant in Cornwall again. Well, what is it that keeps you here?
So I love what I do. And for me, what matters to me is using my expertise to make a difference, to save lives, to really make sure that our warfighters have got the best support they can possibly get. We ask our armed forces to put their lives on the line, put themselves in harm's way to keep us all safe. If, as a scientist, I can do something that can help them, I feel like that is my moral responsibility to do that. And frankly, I get paid enough to have a good quality of life. I'm not getting rock star wages. I couldn't afford a leaky butlin's thing rather than a leaky tent. But for me, what's much more important is feeling like I've got a purpose in what I do, feeling like I'm able to really be working at the bleeding edge of science and engineering. So for me, I just get so motivated. I've worked in university labs in the past, and at DSTL, I get the chance to see my science being put into action in the real world, and that is priceless.
I hope you enjoyed that podcast and finding out more about what DSTL is doing with artificial intelligence. If you enjoyed that podcast, please do like and subscribe and leave us some feedback. And don't forget, you can head to wavelroom.com to read our latest content. Thanks again, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Soldier, A Sailor, and A Scientist.